Love. Some would say it took a backseat when the pandemic forced us apart. As a family-run and proudly Canadian-owned company, Charm Diamond Centers saw the need to bring us together with tales of love and created the Canadian Love Map podcast. Since then, we've shared hundreds of real, uplifting stories that prove love conquers all. So thank you for listening. We couldn't do it without you. And remember, love starts here. What the world needs now is love. More love.
Stars literally aligned.
He's always been the one.
There's someone out there for everyone.
I'm Nancy Regan, your host on the Canadian Love Map. We are on a journey to uncover and share love stories of all kinds.
He's never forgotten to bring me flowers.
We're hoping we're going to give a little good news to this world.
Even in these dark times, the life continues to go on.
It's all about compassion, devotion, adventure, and of course, love.
Everybody needs somebody. Everybody needs love.
This is the Canadian Love Map.
Well, love is the most important thing.
I think if you could take feelings that are hurt and resentment and anger, and if you could turn it into something creative and positive, then, you know, you're not only helping yourself, but you're kind of being a little bit like a lighthouse for others. Like you're setting a trail or a path to let others know that they're going to be okay, that, you know, you might be struggling right now, but this too shall pass.
Today's love story belongs to Paul Bromby. Life can be tough, but often we find strength and inspiration from our role models. Growing up in the north end of Halifax, Paul Bromby was a kid who carried the weight of the world on his shoulders. His mother was fighting a battle, suffering from bipolar disorder. Paul felt alone, like the only kid in the world experiencing what he was going through. However, he eventually found confidence on a basketball court, and he found support from the coaching community around it. In fact, sport was his path to an amazing career, leading to his current role as a senior producer with Sportsnet. Now, Paul's giving back. He wanted to share his story. He wanted other kids growing up to know they're not alone. So he wrote a children's book that is making story time a safe space to talk about mental health. This is the Canadian Love Map. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the Canadian Love Map.
Hi, Nancy, and thank you for having me.
I want to start with a bit of a confession because I want to be transparent. And that is to say that I may have cheered against you when you were playing basketball back in the day.
I understand. And you know what? A lot of people probably did. Were you cheering for Dal or were you cheering for Acadia?
I went to St. Evex. So
Okay.
Well, I will say that I am absolutely cheering for you now because I'm so inspired by this new project of yours. And I know you've had a very successful career outside of this project, but this is what we're talking about today. And I know that it's going to light up a lot of people, this conversation.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I think it's been a while. When my mom passed, I was always thinking of ways that I would want to honor her and thought about documentaries, thought about short films. I love to write and, you know, just writing was a way that I could express my feelings. And so the children book idea came to me about 10 years ago. And probably about 5 years ago, I met a person named Jason DeRocha, who was working a sport ball, and my son was there, and he had written two books, and we just spoke and thought it was a great idea to write a children's book and hopefully help start those conversations about mental health at a young age.
Let's start our conversation by talking about your mom. Let's bring her into this and tell me about her, Paul.
Wow, that's a great question. I think through this whole process, I've come to realize how strong she was. I think when you're young, you look at mental illness as a weakness, or if you're not familiar with mental illness, you look at it as a weakness. And I think when you become an adult, you understand how hard it is just to get out of bed some days and just to, you know, go to work, the bills. raising a child, especially a boy who probably was acting out and acting up quite a bit in school. So I think now I could speak better to who my mom was. My mom lived with bipolar disorder, but she was an incredible, strong woman who loved me more than anybody on this earth. Like, I really, you know, what I may have thought I lacked in, you know, the kind of the mom figure, you know, like the conversations, the guidance, the different things, she made up for tenfold with how much she loved me. And she would support me no matter what I did. And she was very supportive in my basketball career. It was something that she always, you know, spoke about, bragged about to others. And she was just a very loving, beautiful person.
Tell me about her story, if you would.
My mom grew up in Halifax, Nova Scotia. She had two brothers and three sisters. So came from a big family and, you know, had a fairly normal childhood and then moved to Toronto at 19, got married young and went through some domestic abuse and things that really, you know, for lack of a better word, broke her. And she had her first mental breakdown here in Toronto when she was 19. And her father, my grandfather, drove to Toronto, brought her back home. And then I think the next, you know, 5 years or so was kind of recovery and trying to get back on track and got a lot of help at the Nova Scotia Hospital. And then I came along when she was 25. And I think from all accounts, I kind of became her world. And, you know, like, I don't think I could have been loved more by one person than my mom. Because of the illness, she wasn't able to work. So she was a stay-at-home mom with me and was very focused on, you know, hanging out with me. We would dance. I remember dancing as a kid in the house, teaching me how to jive. She loved music, country music. We played a lot of crib. That's very maritime, I'm sure, but we would play a lot of cards growing up. And she was just a great mom, would try to do her best and you know, take me to different playgrounds and different things and just was a great loving person. But as far as her life, I think mental illness really, really kind of took her off the rails at age 19. And the rest was a really big struggle for her. What had happened to her, she just wasn't able to move on from it.
So for those who don't know a lot about bipolar, can you describe the trajectory for her and how did it show up as real highs and lows? You talk about that fun stuff of dancing and you know, having joyful times together. Were there a lot of peaks and valleys?
There were. And I, you know, I'm not a mental health expert. I'm a mental health advocate. And so I think that I should clear that right away because, you know, if you need help, you should go get help. But from my perspective growing up, my mom would be, you know, and I say the word normal for long stretches of times. And when I would really see her getting sick, it would start with depression. She would be in her room crying a lot, and then it would become manic. And when she was manic, it just really didn't know kind of if she was going to be home when I got home, what, you know, what kind of mood she was going to be in. Her thoughts would race. She would be, you know, like if what little money we did have, she would spend sometimes, which would cause extra stress. And now you have to buy food and pay for the bills and pay the bills and all those types of things. But it really is a roller coaster of emotions. And as a little boy, and that's your mom, you see her going through that. I was along for the ride. I couldn't differentiate. I couldn't separate myself from her moods. And so when she was up, I was up. And when she was down, I was down. And I think that led to a big part of this book of wanting children to know that the burdens of their parents aren't theirs to carry. And I just didn't know how to separate myself from it. So when she was up, yeah. And then when I got a little older, though, the manic part. And when she was manic was much more concerning for me. That's when I really felt like I needed to get her to the emergency room or the Nova Scotia hospital to get treatment and get help.
Did you have another adult who was someone you could turn to during these really challenging times?
Not really. I mean, my father was working for Via Rail, so he was 3 days on, 3 days off. And of course, you know, when he was around, it was a little easier, but also he was a heavy drinker and it became an issue in the home where, you know, there was abuse, you know, emotionally and verbally and physically at times. So it almost became me and my mom against him and the rest of the world in some ways. So it was tough. I don't speak about that side a whole lot because it just, he's not here anymore. It's not really my story to tell, but it wasn't easy and it was difficult. And I think that added to her stress as well and would lead to some of the breakdowns that she would have. I did confide in some teachers and coaches later on in life, in high school. I know I had an exam one morning, but I had to take my mom to the emergency room till 3 or 4 in the morning to get her help. Had an exam at 8 or 9 the next morning. Obviously wasn't in the shape to write it. And this lady, Miss McBurney, Halifax West, she was just very compassionate, very loving. And I mean, you know, how many years later, I still remember how sweet she was to me and how, you know, how she kind of made me feel like it was just a test and don't worry about it. Everything's going to be okay. So yeah, there were some adults that I could trust, but I had a lot of shame and embarrassment towards my mom and the disease, more towards the disease. So I hid it from others. And I think if I was growing up now with campaigns like Bell Let's Talk and different programs and awareness, I wouldn't be as embarrassed and ashamed. But back then, as I'm sure you know, in the 70s and 80s, nobody really talked about mental health. And it was almost like, oh, just, you know, don't talk about it. Just push them over here. And there was definitely a stigma around her illness.
So how did you talk about how your moods were very attached, like there was an elastic, you know, attached to hers. How else did it impact you as you grew in terms of your personality and how you showed up in the world?
That's also a good question. I think like in school, I would try to make people laugh. I think because my mom was depressed at times and sad at times, that I would try to get the attention that I felt like I wanted in ways that might not have been great, but I would try to be funny and sometimes be the class clown. And then I kind of gravitated towards sports, and I would get the attention through sports to build up my self-esteem and make me feel better about things. My friends would also say I would always try to be happy and be funny. And because I felt like life was pretty sad at home, that when I was outside, I wanted to enjoy life and enjoy myself. And sports really helped me find that confidence to be myself and be a happier person.
When did you make friends with the basketball? I can just picture it in your hands now.
Yeah, it really did. This is no exaggeration. Basketball saved my life. It really just gave me structure, and it gave me family and brothers, and gave me male role models and coaches that I really needed at a young age. I started playing for Canadian Martyrs in the south end of Halifax for Dave McIntosh, who played at St. Mary's from the north end. And so that really became kind of my first organized basketball. We used to play at the pit in the north end all the time. And you know, you play from morning till night till the lights came on. But organized basketball, Canadian Martyrs, and then ended up going to St. Pat's High School, where I played for Hugh McDonald there. And he was great. And then Halifax West with Nick Morash, and he was great. Mount St. Vincent for Rick Plato, who's now at Dal, and then St. Mary's with Ross Quackenbush. So I was kind of all over the place. We moved quite a bit when I was younger, but I think I was also lucky because it exposed me to so many different people and different teachings through basketball that I've been able to, you know, share those as well here in Ontario.
If you go back to discovering basketball at the beginning of that career you talk about, how did it feel in relation to how you often felt walking to school in the morning, for instance? Tell me about how it was an escape or whatever it represented.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Basketball became my sanctuary. It became my safe place. It became my spot where I was in control. I might not have been in control of making every shot I wanted to make, but I knew that if I put the effort in, if I put the work in, that there would be results. And sometimes the things at home, I had no control over. I could love my mom as much as I wanted. I could do everything for her, but I could not, you know, change her illness. And I could not make her better, no matter how hard I tried to make her laugh or, you know, tried to be there as a son. And, you know, I think at home, when I got older, it became anger and resentment. And those are real. And there was a lot of guilt when my mom passed, because I don't think I treated her the way that I wanted to. It didn't show her how much I loved her until she was gone. And, you know, a lot of this book and a lot of, you know, things that I post on social media are really a way for me to try to, you know, just be better and show other people that, you know, it's nobody's fault if someone's sick, and it's okay to not be okay. And I wish I had known that when I was younger. So basketball, you know, getting back to basketball, it really was just a safe place. I had control over everything. If I missed a shot, oh, well, I can get back and play defense and rebound. There was things that I could still control in the games. And I had great teammates and I play for great teams. So the winning also gave you a little bit of confidence and made you feel walk a little taller when you're out in the world. That, you know, I see that now with my own son. He's discovered basketball and he's 5'3" and he's 10, just turned 10 years old. He's a big kid, but it gives him that confidence to walk straight up, not be ashamed of his height, and just, you know, enjoy it.
Yeah. And the sense of connection that you derive from belonging to a team like that just can't be overstated, can it?
No, I think no matter what, I'm so happy that my son loves a sport. It, you know, it could be hockey, it could be soccer, it could be basketball, but you really learn so many life lessons through sport. And, you know, failure is a good thing. I know a lot of us, you know, try to avoid failure in our lives and in our careers and playing sports, but I've said this before, I probably learned more from losses than I ever did from wins. I learned about myself. Well, now what are you going to do? You lost. Are you going to try to get better? Are you going to sulk about it? Are you going to get up? Are you going to be a good teammate? And those are things that I try to coach into children now. And, you know, I always think of this, but, you know, uncoachable kids are unemployable adults. And so if they can learn those lessons early in life of how to be part of a team and how to handle failure, then I think it would help them later in life.
That's amazing. You know, I literally said those words to my 17-year-old daughter 4 days ago, that you learn a lot more from your losses than you do your wins. So, Paul, how did you get on the path to sports broadcast?
So I was working for doing sales for a web design company here in Toronto, and it would have been 1999. And people really didn't know what a website was back then. That makes me sound archaic. Yeah. And if they did know what a website was, their cousin could build it. And it was fine. They didn't need to buy one from us. So I was watching TV one day and I was watching sports. I love sports. And Sportsnet was on, and I was like, you know what? I want to work in sports broadcast media. So part of my job was cold calling. So I cold called the Score. They weren't hiring. TSN, they weren't hiring. I even cold called CBC Sports. They weren't hiring. Sportsnet was my last call, and I literally was going through the phone book to find the number. I got through Sportsnet reception, and I asked if they were hiring. And this lady, who still remains a friend today, said, "We are hiring," because they were fairly new. It was probably a year or so. They were CTV Sportsnet. I got through, put through to the hiring manager, Stuart Aker, and he gave me a sports quiz. And by the end of it, he said, "You have the job." And I quit my job. I was ready to move back to Halifax. I was, you know, and he said, "You start in 2 weeks." And that was pretty much when my last paycheck would have come through. And the rest is kind of history in a way. But I started at an entry-level job. I didn't know anything about media or television back then. So I would go in on my days off. I would shadow the control room, master control, some of the other producers, directors, assignment desk. And I would just ask questions and try to learn as much as I could. And I've been very lucky that that's been my career for 25 years. Now senior producer overseeing Sportsnet Central and editorial and working with talent and producers to tell the best stories. And I think, you know, I don't feel like I've worked a day there. It's always been pretty rewarding. I know the hours are tough because there's nights and weekends, and but as far as the job itself, it's very rewarding, and it's been great.
What's the most joyful part of it?
You know, I think it's the most joyful part of playing basketball is just being part of a team and being part of a great team. And when I started there, we were miles behind TSN in ratings, and now we've been ahead of them for quite a while now. And that's due in part to having the national rights to hockey, but being part of a team and just having a goal, and it's very fast paced, as I'm sure you know. Working in a control room is like, you know, use the example of a duck. Everything seems calm on air, but in the control room, sometimes we're paddling and scrambling and trying to remain calm, but we're not. And yes, I think just being part of a team, telling stories, and just it's a really high, you know, people are highly driven in that industry. And, you know, being able to survive in it for 25 years, as I'm sure you can understand, has not been easy, but it's been very rewarding.
You make me laugh, Paul, because I think about having been a co-host and co-producer at one point of an hour-long live TV show. And often it would be, you know, hell on wheels, excuse the expression. And my co-host, co-producer, and I would go up to visit the news director afterwards and be cringing, thinking, oh, he's going to be, his head's going to be blowing off. And he'd say, great show. And it was because the people in the control room, in that, you know, very intense atmosphere, were able to hide all the problems. And I guess as a team, and you talk about that teamwork, 100%. As a team, we were able to make it look like a silk purse instead of a sow's ear.
Yes. And it's chicken salad out of chicken. And yeah, so I think as producers and newsroom control room people, we earn our money. And when it's really exciting and fun, quite honestly, is when things go wrong, because you need a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, and keep going. And I've had so many moments, you know, the power shut off one time and we were live on air and I had to get through the rest of the show without being able to come back on camera because there was no lights. People were reading scripts with flashlights on their phones. But after that, we went out and had some beers. We're like, man, that was incredible. Like the adrenaline rush, knowing you got through it. And people at home probably had no idea how wild it was, in the control room or behind the scenes. So yeah, it's very rewarding in that way.
It goes back to learning more from your losses than your wins. We couldn't share the great stories that we do here on the Canadian Love Map podcast without the amazing support of Charm Diamond Centres. They are Canada's largest family-owned jeweler, and they're proud to be putting love on the map. The folks at Charm Diamond Centres are thrilled to be a part of your love story. So visit charmdiamondcentres.com or one of your local stores. Love starts here. I'm wondering now if you can tell me about the healing journey that had to take place between what you describe as that resentment and shame and the point at which you found compassion for your mom, you know, after, as you say, when she died, you realized that you hadn't understood as well. What was that healing journey and what took place during that time?
Well, I think the healing journey started almost immediately. My Aunt Karen called me and told me that my mom had passed. And so now I had to book a flight to Toronto or from Toronto to Halifax and start working on funeral arrangements. And all I could think about the whole time was writing her eulogy and just, I need to tell the world how great a person she was and how loving she was and how amazing she was, because I feel like I hid her from so many people that they didn't really know her full story. They didn't know how funny she was. You know, she had a great sense of humor. They didn't know, you know, how much she loved music. She loved Alan Jackson and how just simple things would light up her life, like a can of Pepsi or an Alan Jackson song. And so those were the things that were really running through my mind when I was heading home. And then when I was delivering the eulogy, and a big part of the eulogy for me was also to treat women with respect, because I don't think I treated women with respect growing up as much as I should have. And I think a lot of that went back to my resentment towards my mom. And, you know, even saying this, a light bulb goes off, because it's not easy to admit those things, you know, when you're growing up and people, especially growing up in Halifax, people see you struggle. People don't really necessarily know why you were struggling. And a big part of it was how much I loved her and how hard it was for me to see the struggles that she was going through. So the part of the healing process was just being open about it at first, discussing her illness. And then things like the book really have helped heal even more.
Mm-hmm. I was guessing that writing the book was part of your healing. But I'm also curious, before we get into the book, to ask you, I guess, what may be a very personal question, but that's what I specialize in. I, in my experience, learning to accept other people as whole beings with the good, the bad, and the ugly has been really connected to accepting myself as all of that, instead of needing to be just the light instead of the darkness, as, you know, to use an overused metaphor, I guess. Was that part of it for you, self-acceptance?
Yeah, I think I went through a separation with my son's mom, and I think a lot of those old hurt feelings came to the surface going through that separation. And I think I started reading a lot of books, and a lot of the books were about spirituality and energy and different things like that, that helped me forgive myself. And, you know, I went to therapy and started speaking to somebody. I always fought against therapy because I thought if I went to talk to somebody, I was saying that I was sick like my mom. As childish as that sounds, I carried that into my 40s. And being able to talk to somebody and express the feelings and emotions and things that I was still going through really helped me heal. And I think you nailed it, is being able to embrace that we all have a dark side, a side that we don't love as well. You know, a little bit of road rage and traffic and, you know, a temper that I probably shouldn't have. But it's also what makes us human. And working on that and trying to be better people and trying to recognize when it starts to build up that, you know, you're going to explode. You know, I work in a very intense work environment at Sportsnet, and being in a control room and producing, there were times where, you know, I would blow up at somebody and then after I would feel so awful because I knew it wasn't their fault. If something went wrong, that it was on me. And I just had to really come to terms with that. I need to work on myself and work on controlling the anger and the emotions.
Wow. That's powerful. I also think that this book, as healing as it is for other people, could only have happened at the, you know, at not the end, but towards the end of that really important and difficult journey of healing for you. So when did the idea surface for a book?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because the original book that I thought in my head was almost very childish. It was like a nursery rhyme. And the more I wrote out my feelings and wrote out things and started talking to Jason, who is the publisher and co-author, about some of the stories and things that had happened in my life, like the story of things that had happened in the book actually happened. And so it was easier to make a story out of it, basing it on things that I went through. And I think I just always wanted to help others. I think now in life, I coach basketball. You know, I wrote this book. I teach at Centennial College Sports Broadcast Media. And the things I want to do is help others and kind of be the person that I needed when I was younger. And so this book really is something I needed when I was younger. I needed to know it was okay. I needed to know I wasn't alone in the world. And it really started the creative process. And I think if you could take feelings that are hurt and resentment and anger, and if you could turn it into something creative and positive, then, you know, you're not only helping yourself, but you're kind of being a little bit like a lighthouse for others. Like you're setting a trail or a path to let others know that they're going to be okay, that, you know, you might be struggling right now, but this too shall pass. And I think a lot of those things that I've tried to put in the book are part of my healing journey.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I'm very curious to know about that first conversation between you and Jason. Was it a very vulnerable one, or how did this all come up?
So when I first met Jason, he was working at this program called Sportball, and he had written two books, My Mom, My Superhero and Nothing But Yet. And I said, I wanted to write a book about my mom. And I said, but I don't have the experience that you had with your mom. You know, even though now I look at her as a superhero, at the time I didn't. And I want to show children and be vulnerable that, you know, not everyone's life is perfect. And yes, we all love our parents, but, you know, there are some struggles as part of that. And in passing, now that we've completed the book, he said that, you know, when I told him the story, he went to another friend. It's like, I have no clue how I'm going to tell this story. Like, he was just racking his brain. So for him to be able to get that story out of me and work together, it took 5 years, but to put it together really was an incredible accomplishment. And you feel so proud of it the first time you hold the book in your hand. But the journey itself has taken quite a long time. Taysom Martindale did a lot of the images. He did the illustrations for the book. And, you know, without those illustrations, it's just a bunch of words. And it's funny because, this is my first children's book, but part of the process for me was I pictured all of the images more so than the story. So for me, I saw it in my head. And then when I would explain it to him and he would draw them and send them back, I'd be like, oh, that's exactly it. So it was a really cool process. And I think, you know, being in television, being media, creativity is what makes it all go. And telling stories is also what makes it all go. So this was important for me to tell a good story and something that people could relate to, whether they're a child or adult, or if there's mental health or not. We all worry about things. And the backpack being a metaphor for all the worries we have, I think a lot of people can relate to it.
Yeah, that feels like magic when you describe watching him draw what was in your head and seeing it, you know, on paper. I'm curious if you can tell us the story so that to some extent, I love the illustrations, by the way, and I know we can't show them on the podcast, but we'll show them in our social media clips. And if you could just give a description of the book, that would be terrific.
Sure. So Jason had written this book called Nothing But Yet, which was about growth mindset. The Kai is the main character in that book, and his sister's a really good basketball player. So he thinks he could just pick up a basketball and be good at it, which we all know that isn't the case, that you have to put the work in and practice. So he gets to the next stage of his development and growth in basketball, and he makes the school team. He comes to my house and he sees that my living situation isn't the same as his. And throughout this process, my mom obviously is a character in it, and he can see that I'm embarrassed and ashamed and worry about her. And the backpack is, you know, it gets, there's animals in the backpack that kind of come into the story. And these animals get more animated and more aggravated as Paul gets stressed. And when he worries about his mom, you can see it in the animals. And then it comes to the city championship, the big game for Halifax West. And there's a, you know, there's a big moment in that game. And there's moments before that where Paul is able to talk to his mother about his feelings and how he's worried about her. And I don't think I really was able to do that as a child. So a lot of this is me speaking to my 7-year-old self. And we talk about healing and journeys. And my first reading at a school, we did a military trail here in Scarborough. And there was, you know, 100 kids, two sessions, but this 1 7- or 8-year-old child put up his hand and said, you know, my mom has mental illness and I worry about her. And oh, yes. And I
put my hand on my heart for the record. That's what he's saying.
Yeah. I froze for a second because, like I said, it was like talking to my 7-year-old self and told him how brave he was to stand up and talk and told him that he's going to be okay and that all he needs to worry about is being a child and going to school and that those worries aren't his to carry. And it was just a complete full circle moment. You know, I got in my car afterwards and I just cried for about 10 minutes because I felt like he's who I wrote the book for. That child is why I wrote this book, and it was so special.
Wow, I can literally hear a click as you unlocked something for him. And that's incredible. I have had that almost exact experience in a different context, speaking to a group of junior high students about my own relationship with fear and how I felt like a total dork, even when I was on TV, you know, interviewing celebrities and so on, that secretly I felt like an inner dork and that my greatest mission was to conceal that from the world. And I had a kid come up to me afterwards, a young boy, and said, you know, I thought I was the only one that felt like that. And I did the same thing as you. I went out after the session to my car and just cried for a good number of minutes because
it's a good cry.
Like a relief. Yeah.
It's a good cry and a relief. I think for me, it's like, this feels like my purpose in a lot of ways, and it validated my purpose and allowed me to know that I'm making a difference. At least if I make a difference in that one child's life, then all of this was worth it. And again, very healing, you know, made all the hours putting into the book worth it. And Jason, when we get outside, is like, dude, you manifested that. You said this exact same thing was going to happen. Like I said, I could picture us in the gym talking to kids and one kid puts his hand up and says, my mom is also, you know, battling with mental illness. And it happened the first reading I did. And it was just so powerful.
Okay, you're ruining my mascara.
I'm sorry. You know, I would say these conversations can be very heavy, very difficult. But I feel like if the book is introduced to the home and schools, that it's okay to get sad or cry or, you know, release that emotion, because holding on to it is not good. And these conversations need to be had, and we need to have discussions about mental health, and we need to realize that it's okay to not be okay. And it's all right to be sad or upset at times.
Well, particularly when anxiety is at epidemic levels for teenagers.
Agreed. And I think with social media, there's so much pressure on younger people to be perfect. And we never put our struggles on social media. We just put the perfect world up. I mean, myself included. I don't put up there that I get a flat tire and today sucks and all those different things, because quite honestly, I think that we should try to put positive out there in the world. But those negative, bad things do happen. And I think, you know, anxiety for children in school to be judged, and they have to look a certain way. They have to, you know, have to go to a certain school and have to do certain things that are impressive to others. And I know I suffered through this by feeling like I'm not good enough. I've always, like you were saying, kind of it felt like a dork. I always felt like I wasn't good enough. And when I had a good game in basketball, oh man, I was on top of the world. Even in old man's leagues, if I had a bad game, I would go home and feel like crap. Even in old man's leagues, I attached too much of success and failure in basketball to my own worth. And I had to get away from that. And I think we do that with careers. We do that with relationships. And it's just not healthy. We're good enough. You know, we're just going through different experiences.
So what sort of reaction have you gotten from parents and other kids as well?
The reaction has been overwhelming. We sold out 500 books. We printed 500 books. We sold out in 3 weeks. And I would say 90% of that would be from Nova Scotia, which is amazing when the people you grew up with support you in that way. It's just incredible. And also here in Ontario, when I've gone to the school, the teachers have given amazing feedback. A lot of teachers and people that work in that field said this should be in every curriculum across the country, and that these conversations need to be had. And so it's been very powerful. I've actually almost set up myself for the negative feedback as well, because I think it's a very touchy subject. I think we all have our own kind of how we live through life, and some of us aren't open and willing to talk about those things. And I haven't had it yet as much, but I've prepared myself for it. And that's okay. I'm just sharing my story. It doesn't have to resonate with everybody, but I'm going to share my story.
Paul, I'm curious, when you talk about having found your purpose through this, I wonder if you look back at your challenges in childhood and have the ability to say, oh yeah, it didn't happen to me, it happened for me.
That's bang on. And I know, religion and spirituality is something that we don't often talk about in public because we feel like we're judged by it. But when I think back to I prayed a lot as a kid, and, you know, and I got through those times by praying and thinking that there's a reason for this. You know, I grew up in the Catholic school system. I went to church. So that's probably where it came from. But I had a belief that the bad things that were happening within my family, there was a greater purpose for it. And, you know, part of the greater purpose was helping me grow and helping me understand. And also maybe my experience is going to help somebody else that know that they're not alone in this, and that a lot of people are going through it. And I think since COVID, a lot more people are going through different mental health challenges and anxiety with how the cost of living in our country right now, there's a lot of stress and a lot of people are going through it. And I think if we understand that we're not alone in these struggles, that it definitely helps others.
I am hearing echoes of you saying your mother in your realization now was so strong. And I think about the fact that the vulnerability you've shown by telling this story is a superpower. You know, you might have thought vulnerability at different stages of your path was weakness. As you described mental illness being a weakness in your eyes in the early days. But do you feel like it's your superpower now to be able to really look at that shame and say to the world, here's my story in a very vulnerable way?
Yeah, because I think we are so fearful of being judged, and vulnerability, you know, a lot of my posts on social media, you know, be about my mom. And I'm sure there's people that read it and roll their eyes like, oh, going on about his mom again. But I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with being vulnerable now where I wasn't before, because I think from being little boys and playing sports, we're taught that we need to suck it up and be tough and don't cry and all those different things, which is completely wrong. Showing vulnerability, showing emotions is a strength. And I think, in order to be a great leader, you need to be vulnerable. And you also need to be able to admit that you're not always right. And I think too many times, especially on social media, we just go on there to be the keyboard warrior, like, no, my opinion is right. And it's not always the case. So I think, yeah, vulnerability and being able to share the story. It's not as hard as it was. And I feel like it gets easier the more I share it. But there's still times where I don't feel openly comfortable, you know, sharing my story to the world, because, you know, part of me is being judged. Part of my mom is being judged. But I'm okay with that, because, like I said, that one kid at that one school, if that makes a change in his life, that's all worth it.
Well, I really appreciate you being willing to share your story with us and the story of your mom today. And I am just appreciative of how you're showing up in the world.
Well, thank you very much. And you're somebody that I looked up to over the years in your career in media. And it means a lot to be on the show with you and to really kind of get to know you. And it's funny, I feel like we have some very similar thoughts on things. And I'm very appreciative as well.
Is the book available now? That's a big question I have to answer for my listeners.
Yes, the book is available now, juniorstorytellers.com. The backpack, you'll see some of the other books is there as well, but juniorstorytellers.com. That's where you can purchase the book now, for now. And then hopefully, you know, we'll get into bookstores, really hoping it gets into different schools and libraries across Canada and in the US and in the world. I feel like this is just the start of it. The feedback has been incredible. And yeah, so juniorstorytellers.com.
I look forward to seeing it translated into many, many languages.
Me too. I can't wait. It's really, as I say, I feel like we're just the tip of the iceberg with this. And it's been a great journey so far, and can't wait to see where it takes us.
Right on. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the Canadian Love Map. This podcast is presented and made possible by Charm Diamond Centers. It's hosted by me, Nancy Regan, and is produced and distributed by Podstarter. We love sharing love stories of all kinds, and that could include yours. So do you or someone you know have an uplifting tale to tell? Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram using @CanadianLoveMap or email producer@podstarter.io. We'll be back next week with another love story to add to the map.